My name is Mark Schwain, and together with my wife, I'm coordinating the summer teaching staff here at Holden. Many of you I know were at last evening's forum, and so I don't perhaps have to be quite as extensive in explaining how forums work. In any case, this one's going to be quite different from the one we had last evening, both in terms of subject matter and in terms of some of the introductory material, which, as you might guess, will take the form of a brief visual presentation. Tonight's question is, can American Indians survive American justice? And that's a very broad question. And our two special presenters this evening, who will start it off, will narrow that question quite a bit for us, focusing specifically and especially on matters having to do with freedom of religion, a number of interesting and urgent situations have arisen quite recently involving freedom of religion for Native American peoples. So without further ado, let me introduce the two folks who will be speaking with us. Some of you attended Eric's session earlier. He sits to my left, two over, and at 6:45 he presented us with quite a lot of rich background information on the general topic of Native American Christian spirituality, the search for common ground, and established a kind of broad framework for thinking of the clash between and among cultures that began at least 500 years ago. And he will be introducing the video portion of the presentation and telling you perhaps a bit about his own work, which before he became the registrar here at Holden Village, included his being a pastor among Native American peoples in northwestern California. Then to my immediate left, Ed Gaffney, who is the dean of the law school at Valparaiso University. Ed has written very extensively on the on freedom of religion and recently testified before Congress on the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, an act which was framed and formulated in large part in response to a number of cases, which Ed will report at least on some of them, involving freedom of religion for Native American peoples. So that very broad question, can American Indians survive American justice, will really be given focus on the freedom of religion issue, and even more focus on matters that have recently arisen in this country involving that issue. So let me turn the proceedings then over to Eric and Ed, and then I'll help moderate the conversation after they've started.
Thank you very much, Mark. The way my perspective in going into this is not objective. It's very biased. Having served in Native American ministry and worked closely with Indian communities in northwestern California, I was an advocate on behalf of the Lutheran Church and got the Lutheran Church involved in becoming advocates for Native American religious freedom, specifically in relation to one particular case which originated in the mountains of northwestern California. You're going to see some background information coming out on a brief video presentation that we'll do on this one case, which was called, in the layman's terms, the Go Road case. It had to do with a logging road from a place called Gaskee, that's the G, to a place called Orleans, that's the O, therefore the Go Road. In legal terms, it was the Ling case. Ling, who is the name of the Secretary of Agriculture, versus the Northwest Indian Cemetery Protective Association and others. The people you'll see in this presentation were all involved in the case, either as Native American practitioners of their tribal religion, faith, or as official plaintiffs in the case, which went on to the Supreme Court. You'll also see a short excerpt from the lawyer, Marilyn Miles, the attorney who argued the case before the Supreme Court. And after this presentation, we'll talk briefly about what happened in this particular court case, and then go on from there. So I'm a lay person when it comes to law, but when it comes to religion and theology, I'm an ordained pastor, and I'm a zealous advocate for religious freedom. That's my perspective.
I am a lay person in my church and a zealous advocate of religious freedom for all in constitutional law.
Okay. So we complement each other in that way. I thought I would go ahead and start the video then. If you could turn your weight around and catch one of these monitors. I've got an excerpt that's on one tape and another excerpt on another tape. They're both fairly brief. Let me know if the sound is not loud enough.
Indians were real religious people, and they believed a lot of prayer. They prayed for everything they did. Just on the one place I'm here, we're just on fighting for this one little place there. It's a sacred ground. It's important that these places be left for the people to go and talk with God.
Six Rivers National Forest in Northwest California. It encompasses nearly 100,000 acres. Through a portion along the Siskiyou Mountains runs the GO Road, one section starting in Gaskee in the north, the other in Orleans in the south.
The road has been in business probably for some 30 to 40 years, and over time the Forest Service has upgraded various portions of it. Initially it was a low standard road, and the upgrading consists of widening the road and basically surfacing the road.
The road is roughly 6.5 miles short of completion. It's called the Chimney Rock section. Chimney Rock, it and the area around it, considered by the people of the three Northwest California Indian tribes to be the most sacred of grounds.
There is the home of prayer. The ones that are responsible for us as people. That's where they live. It's an area that is for prayer. People do use it. They're received by the chayyim that live there. It's heavy, repeated concentration of instructions to your mind through a process of crying, through dancing and jumping all night long for many days.
Chris Peters is at the head of what is now nearly a 10-year fight to keep the Forest Service from completing the GO Road. Step one, to convince Western culture that Indian beliefs indeed constitute a religion.
It's been clearly established by the Forest Service experts, clearly established by all lower courts, that a religion definitely exists.
Well, we've found out that indeed the area is used extensively by local Native American people of the Yurok, Karuk, and Totoro tribes.
Dottie Theodorata is one of the anthropologists who did studies for the Forest Service. There is no doubt in her mind that completion of the road would have a detrimental effect.
If that area were to be impacted, as it would be significantly by this road, these practices wouldn't be, they can't be transferred to another place. They have to be done there.
Increased access to the high country brought about by the completion of the road is what the Indians fear most, and what the Forest Service most wants. For logging and recreational purposes.
It serves access to the associated wilderness. It serves access for hunting and fishing, normal recreational use, and also from administrative use, fire access into the areas.
So once the road is completed, then we'll have a lot of people jumping out of their cars and running over to our sacred places.
Ultimately, for the Indians, the question even goes beyond religion. For many, the point is survival. They are what they believe, not only this generation, but for future generations as well.
Moment.
Indian witnesses and Forest Service witnesses testifying before a federal district court judge, the court found that the Chimney Rock section of the Golan would in fact seriously interfere with the religious rights of the Indian people who practice in that area. This was not surprising, since the Forest Service's own experts, after at least a year's study of the issue, had found that indeed construction of that road would seriously interfere with the practices and posed a serious threat of undermining the religious system itself for these people. The district court further found that the reasons that the federal government said they needed this road did not stand up to scrutiny. They were not sufficient to justify the impact that this would have upon the Indian people of that area. A federal court of appeals reviewed all of this testimony and agreed with what the district court had found. The U.S. Supreme Court will now get an opportunity to rule whether or not the First Amendment protects the religious rights of these people. It is not ironic that they will rule on this issue in this year, our 200th anniversary of the Constitution. They will have an opportunity to decide whether the First Amendment applies equally to Indian people as it does to other religions in this country. It's important to realize that in this case, Indian people are not asking the government to give them anything at all. All they ask is that the government not do something to them. They ask that they respect their religious practices and not to destroy a sacred site and practices that predate the government even coming onto the scene in this area and becoming the owners of the property at issue. I think the request that the Indian people make in this case is without question fully in accord with the values of the First Amendment.
When that tape was made, Marilyn Miles had yet to represent the plaintiffs before the Supreme Court. That took place on November 30th, 1987, when the Supreme Court heard that case. On April 19th, 1988, the court decided the case against the Indian plaintiffs and with the U.S. Forest Service on a vote of 5-3. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor wrote the opinion for the majority. Let me quote just a few paragraphs from that opinion. It is undisputed that the Indians' respondents' beliefs are sincere, that the government's proposed action will have severe adverse effects on the practice of their religion. The respondents contend that the burden of their religious practice is heavy enough to demonstrate a compelling need to complete the Go Road or to engage in timber harvesting in the Chimney Rock area. We disagree. The affected individuals here would not be coerced by the government's action into violating their religious beliefs, nor would the governmental action penalize the exercise of religious rights by denying religious adherents an equal share of the rights, benefits, and privileges enjoyed by other citizens. The Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment is written in terms of what the government cannot do to the individual, not in terms of what the individual can exact from the government. Even assuming that the government actions here will virtually destroy the Indians' ability to practice their religion, the Constitution simply does not provide a principle that could justify upholding the respondents' legal claims. This was the opinion of the majority. Justice Brennan wrote for the dissenters. Let me quote just a paragraph or two from him. The court concludes that even where the government uses federal land in a manner that threatens the very existence of a Native American religion, the government is simply not doing anything to the practitioners of that faith. The Constitution guarantee we interpret today is directed against any form of governmental action that frustrates or inhibits religious practice. Today, the court holds that a federal land use decision that promises to destroy an entire religion does not burden the practice of that faith in a manner recognized by the Free Exercise Clause. Given today's ruling, that freedom to practice religion amounts to nothing more than the right to believe that their religions will be destroyed. The safeguarding of such a hollow freedom not only makes a mockery of the policy of the United States to protect and preserve for American Indians their inherent right of freedom to believe, express, and exercise their religions, it fails utterly to accord with the dictates of the First Amendment. Just a personal note. Each of the people you saw on the tape were personal acquaintances, in some cases friends of mine. And I have a firm belief that the healing that needs to take place within all communities, but specifically within the communities, Indian people, including the Karuk, the Yurok, the Talawa, the Hoopa that I worked with, as well as other Indian tribes and communities. The healing must begin at and must be concentrated at the very core of the community's life, and that core is the traditional tribal religious and ceremonial expressions. If that wellspring, that core, cannot be reaffirmed and strengthened and built upon, then I don't see any hope for Indian people as tribal people gaining health and wholeness and abundant life. At a ceremony called the Brush Dance, a man named Amos Tripp, who is a Karuk and who happens to be an attorney, said, without this ceremony that we're watching, I'm just another brown-skinned person. For him to be a Karuk meant participation in the religious ceremonial system of his people. That was his choice. That's what identified him. That's what gave him identity as a person. Without that, he said, I'm just another brown-skinned person. The cases that are happening, that happened in the Gold Road, in the Peyote case that Ed will speak about, San Francisco Peaks case that was a Hopi situation, the Medicine Wheel case in Wyoming, the Snoqualmie Falls situation, which is here in northwestern Washington, all of these cry for the involvement of the church. I believe the church has a moral obligation, in view of the bitter and ambiguous harvest of its own missionary efforts among indigenous people. We have a moral obligation to support the religious rights and freedoms of Indian people, to say nothing of our own self-interest in light of the Supreme Court decisions. That's all I'd like to say at this point.
I'd like to add a few comments and then, you know, start the discussion rolling as quickly as we can. Our desire tonight is not to transform you either into anthropologists of Indian culture or Native American culture, nor into legal experts, but to grasp how culture in law can be very oppressive forces destroying religious conviction. That's the kind of purpose of the forum. We put the question very starkly: can Native American religion survive? To put the question that way implies the possibility that it won't. It's a little too early to know the answer to the question, but the way I think both Eric and I read the tea leaves at this moment in history is that it's a real possibility that Native American religion will be one of the tragic victims of the white person's coming to this continent some 500 years ago. I want to say something else even broader, and that the reason why there is ground for such pessimism, and those of you that have been attending the sessions that I've been conducting on Jewish-Christian relations know that I don't use the term survival and annihilation carelessly. I use them to describe a specific effort in history intentionally and purposefully to get rid of a people. And that was the plan of the Third Reich. And I have come to the conclusion that there is not that kind of intentional, overt hostility to the Native Americans in this country, any more than there is to the Lutherans or the Presbyterians or the Baptists or the Catholics and so on. There was such carefully aimed, targeted hostility in our American colonial past. It was targeted primarily at Jews, Turks, and other infidels, by the other infidels were the Roman Catholics. Protestant Christianity was given a preferred place, and those who didn't quite fit the model of the in-group, or the ups, as we heard the other night, the downs were excluded from participation in political life, much in the way that women were and the West African slaves were. This kind of overt hostility isn't really the kind of subtle and callous disregard for the way that religious faith works among the Native Americans. It's a complete misunderstanding of the nature of community. It's a kind of an overlay of, I don't know what Francis of Assisi would make of the slaying of that mosquito, but in any event, it's a misunderstanding of the nature of Native American religion, and I might add, very hastily after that, of biblical faith, to encapsulate religion as though it were some individualistic, privatized experience. That's basically what the court seems to allow. It seems to trivialize religion, put it to the margin of cultural experience, and allow it space there. But when it's either public, ceremonial, or the like, then it grants no serious regard and no adequate protection for the kind of religious faith that is at issue here. I might, for those of you that are unaware of the intentional overt hostility to the Mormons in the last century, I might recite that history ever so briefly in three series of decisions in the late 19th century. The Mormons were told that it's one thing to have a belief, it's another thing to act upon it. And so the court invented a distinction between belief and conduct and said, well, if you want to believe in plural marriages and that stuff, that's your business. But you just can't engage in conduct that is predicated on those beliefs. You can't marry more than one woman at a time. You could have serial polygamy the way Hollywood stars do, or whatever, the more the wise the better, but not at one time. The belief-conduct distinction was wiped out in the second Mormon case, in which the court said it was okay for the federal government to go back to the worst aspects of our colonial history, and I'm sure you've all heard the big lie around Thanksgiving about the colonials being freedom-loving and that the reason why they came to these shores was to promote religious freedom. Don't you believe it? Quakers were hanged on Boston Common as readily as Jesuits and Papists were chased out of the colony or sent to their death. Our ancestors in this continent, that is to say our white ancestors, were not lovers of religious freedom. They were lovers of religious freedom for themselves, vis-a-vis the oppressive denial of religious freedom in the mother country, but they got around to abusing all others outside of their kin pretty quickly. And let me now return to the Mormon story, and then I'll go back to the Native Americans and be quiet. The second Mormon case said, you can't vote, you can't hold public office if you believe nonsensical stuff like plural marriages. So it wasn't a question of a criminal prosecution brought against someone for conduct of engaging in, you know, behavior. It was a declaration that you don't have civil liberties. You can't vote, you can't be in the political life, you are worse than a second-class citizen, you're worse than the back of the bus, you're just not in the Commonwealth for practical purposes if you believe stuff like this. Whereupon Mormons kept believing, but just got excluded from the community. And the third stage of this hostility was to take away all the property of the Mormons, and now things are really getting close to home, whereupon the Mormons changed their belief. It's an unknown story to most of us because I suppose it's not in our history books, and for other reasons that needn't detain us now, but I used that set of cases to illustrate what I think is happening to the Native Americans. They are the alien in the land. They are the natives, and yet they are the alien, the foreign, strange one par excellence. We can't think of anything more weird than not having property rights defined really neatly, clearly. There are few of us here in this room that either doesn't rent an apartment or own a black acre or 40 acres in the back or some smaller version of it, you know, the yay so many three quarters of an acre sort of plot. Even if we did believe in a totally socialist society in which the government owned all the land, and we only got here to Holden Village by a government-owned boat or something like that, or look what happens with Amtrak, or if you do those that like Amtrak, you might like Conrail even better, and then maybe you'd want to understand something of the nature of the control of culture if we move beyond transportation and beyond property rights into the more delicate area of what religious commitments and views of the transcendent are all about. At that point, to borrow a leaf from the Mormon cases, it seems to me that the court is going down, first of all, this belief conduct distinction, saying, well, you can believe strange things about the human spirit if you want to as a Native American, but just don't interrupt the normal operation of the Social Security system. So in order to make sure there aren't welfare cheats out there, we're going to make sure that everybody in the landmass known as the United States of America has a single universal identifying number. The very thing that Alf Langdon said about the Social Security system in 1936, and nobody believed him, is that all that would be left by the end of the century would be a dog tag around everybody's name and immense rules and regulations. No one contemplated in the midst of the Depression that this was going to be a mechanism for getting at Indian beliefs. But the case known as Bowen against Roy, which precedes the Lane case, did precisely that, saying, well, you can have your quaint, funny ideas about the human spirit that would be disturbed by having a number tagging you, but when it comes up against a universally applicable government norm, then your conduct can't interfere with our faith system, that everybody needs this universal identifying number. Now, the second case is the one that Eric has already explained in some detail, which goes to the heart of religious experience among Native Americans, namely that the land itself is sacred. Now, again, in ancient biblical faith, there is a point of contact. The shrines in ancient Israel, Bethel, Gilgal, Shechem, Shiloh, the one that is best known, of course, Zion, or Jerusalem. These places were associated with the memory of the ancestors. And perhaps the best way to illustrate that is for me to read a little bit from this pamphlet that you can get in the bookstore, A Message from Chief Seattle. I might note that it appears to be edited by a white person. Some references in here to the Buffalo Kill, that it at least appears to be after the event, so you've got the glow of a white hand in this document. But never mind, we're not doing form critical study of Indian documents tonight. Let me read this simply to illustrate the importance and significance of land in the belief system of these people. The issue that's presented in the treaty with Chief Seattle is whether or not the government can buy up the land of the natives of this part of the country. And he basically says, well, that's an interesting proposition. We'll think about that one. But we're going to need some time to ponder it. If we do it, he says, then you, for your part, in the treaty, must stipulate to teach your children that the ground beneath their feet is the ashes of our grandparents, so that they will respect the land. Tell your children that the earth is rich with the lives of our kin. Teach your children that what we have taught our children, namely that the earth is our mother. Whatever befalls the earth befalls the children of earth. If the people spit on the ground, they spit upon themselves. This we know. The earth does not belong to the people belong to the earth. This we know. All things are connected, like the blood which unites one family. All things are connected. Well, to take the cases one step further and then be silent, 2 years almost to the day, April the 17th, 1990, the Supreme Court decided another one of these Native American cases, and to encapsulate the series of these cases, it's really easy. The Mormons always lose, the Native Americans always lose, Jews always lose. Whoever's the religious minority, there's profound misunderstanding of the outside group, and there's nothing but contempt heaped upon people like Marilyn in her advocacy of these rights. Anybody who goes before the Supreme Court advocating a claim on a Native American can be expected to be ridiculed and embarrassed from the bench, and to have the case assigned to a junior justice without much care or attention to the writing of the opinion, with utterly glaring inconsistencies between the record in the case, the facts of the case, and what the court purports to announce as its decision. It's a disgraceful piece of American constitutional law. And perhaps the most flagrant violation of any sense of decency occurred in this third of the trilogy of Native American cases, known as Employment Division of the State of Oregon against Smith, which involved two drug counselors in the state of Oregon who lost their job as drug counselors because they ingested an illegal drug. Now, if they were on heroin or doing dope or something like that, I suppose the rationale of the government firing a drug counselor who's doing drugs is pretty clear and obvious. It's not my claim that simply saying, well, I have a religious reason for doing this, means that you can trump an otherwise valid law. Try that speeding to church one Sunday and see how far your excuse gets. But I'm supposed to be in the choir today. If you're a hazard to safety, you can expect to get a ticket and not invoke the First Amendment to beat the ticket. Knowing the cop is a much better way of beating the ticket. In any event, or having a $50 bill in your wallet if you're in Cook County. Back to our cases. The practice of Mr. Smith and the other drug counselor was nothing like, it didn't come close to anything like the object of concern of the so-called war on drugs. People call it smoking peyote. It's only white people that would say that. You don't smoke peyote. Peyote is the bud of a cactus plant. You ingest it like you take communion. You drink the cup and you eat the bread, because these elements entering into you connect you with Jesus, our risen Savior. Well, so also for the Native Americans. It's a form of sacramental communion that in taking this bitter plant, the healing restorative powers of God, which were in this ceremony that antedates the arrival of Columbus to these shores, is thought to have healing sacramental significance. To analogize the Lane case to something that we're familiar with as Christians, it's as though Sandra Day O'Connor said that it would be perfectly okay for the city of New York to take down St. John's Cathedral or St. Patrick's or the chapel at Valparaiso University, the largest Lutheran, or indeed the largest university chapel in the country, for the most frivolous of reasons imaginable, without assigning any serious reason with respect to that land use, and saying, well, it's the government's land, it can do anything it wants with it. It doesn't have to assign a serious or significant reason for interfering with religion. In the peyote case, we were told that in all religion cases in the future, the government doesn't need to come up with a serious reason. Imagine for a moment the head of household in a Jewish family being told that she or he may not serve and I use the term sacramental loosely, but religiously sacred cup that is enjoyed by a Jewish family every Shabbat, or in the context of a Passover Seder meal, to someone who is underage. Since we have a uniform federal law that says that you can't have alcohol under age 21. That would be the situation of the Native Americans. That would be the situation of a Lutheran pastor being told that, that he or she could not administer communion to someone underage without any recourse to the Constitution or the Free Exercise Clause. So as Eric has suggested, the situation is indeed bleak for Native Americans, but from my perspective as a constitutional lawyer, it's worse than that. It's bleak for all of us. Religious freedom has virtually been rendered a nullity at the hands of the court, and the only remedy that is left to us is the political process, getting the attention of legislators to enact a statute which will have the functional equivalent of protecting religious freedom, both communally and an individual conscience.
Okay. Questions, comments? Yes.
Does the new road or the improved road follow the path of the existing road?
The 40-year-old road.
The issue is whether or not to complete the link to get from G to O.
Well, is there a road there now?
There's a gravel path that was that is not used.
You can't log on it.
No, you can't. It can't be used for transportation.
Did the other road go someplace else, or was it not a complete road from G to O?
It wasn't a complete road. The Forest Service, each section that was added was independently added for a different logging plan. I should mention as an amendment to this that when the Siskiyou Wilderness, or when the Smith River National Recreation Act was passed a couple years ago and included one paragraph which we fought for arm, tooth, and nail, and that is it includes now this road corridor, this 6.2-mile road corridor in the Siskiyou Wilderness area. So because of legislation, that road will not be built, will not be completed at this time. But it's a poor situation when we have to resort to legislation rather than rely on Constitution, which is the bedrock of our justice system, to uphold our rights. Because if you can legislate protection for an area, you can unlegislate it. And since it was determined by the court that there is no way you can have the support of the First Amendment of the Constitution, then legislation has become the only solution, and that's a poor solution.
Well, let me suggest why I think it's a better solution than perhaps Eric has suggested. I would agree with him that it's certainly better if we had a solid, clear line of case law construing those words to mean that we all are protected in the exercise of our religious convictions. But as I suggested, the record is extremely bleak from 1972 to the present. It's 20 years of a string of defeats for religious freedom. To imagine that this court is going to get better in the next 10 to 20 years is, I think, banking too much on the intervening hand of God. Three people dissented in Lange: Justice William Brennan, Thurgood Marshall, and Harry Blackmun. Now, two of them are off the court. It's an 8-to-1 court, folks. We're going to see some occasional 7-to-2 decisions. Perhaps the most scandalous record on the court is that of John Paul Stevens, who has never voted in his existence on that court for any religious claim. That's almost as outrageous as Bill Douglas's record on taxes. When he was an ardent New Dealer just fresh on the court, he thought there was no claim of a taxpayer that could ever be correct because the government needed all the money it could get to do its wonderful projects. until the IRS made the stupid mistake of auditing Bill Douglas one day. Whereupon, no claim of the government could ever possibly be correct in a tax case. It's just a clear watershed thing. And everybody said, well, Douglas has just given up on interpretation of tax law. And it's not just that John Paul Stevens has given up on interpretation of tax law. The most famous Lutheran lawyer in the country, William Rehnquist, the Chief Justice of the court, appears never to have met a statute he doesn't like. The Will Rogers approach to jurisprudence, that if a city council enacts a law, well, Rehnquist will find a way of saying the Constitution doesn't interfere with the right of the legislature to do that. And there's a big, hence, it seems to me, the only place to turn when you've got a status court is to the legislature. It is the ideal remedy. When the Jews are told that they can be bounced out of the military for wearing a yarmulke, you know the Republic's in trouble. And that's what Rehnquist said in the Goldman and Weinberger case. But relief was available because the Jews are well enough organized as a minority to get support to make Congress turn that around with adequate legislation. And I think it's as improbable to think that Congress will repeal that statute as to think that it would repeal the civil rights legislation of the 1960s. It's not going to do that. Once Congress gets the point that legislation is necessary, it's not going to undo that. The problem is the build-up, the lead-up to that point. And right now we have a court that just doesn't care about these matters, and I think the only place to turn, from my perspective where I sit, is to the other branch, or to the other two branches, the Congress and the executive. So that's a small difference between us. I think we agreed on the necessity of supporting this particular statute, which is kind of generic in scope. It's like the language of this, prohibiting the free exercise thereof. It doesn't purport to end all controversies over the extent of the protection that you derive from the Constitution. It just says, well, if you're a government lawyer, you at least have to come into court with some kind of an important reason for trumping a religious claim. Right now, it's kind of a joke. Government lawyers just win case after case after case. And that's got to be stopped.
You said Rehnquist is a Lutheran?
Yeah.
William Rehnquist is a Lutheran.
Pardon?
I hope he has the LCA.
Harlan, well, you had a question?
We'll get into that one.
That wasn't was that a burial ground too, along with their sacred ground? Or they're not supposed to touch a burial ground, are they, or do they?
Well, it isn't that the burial ground itself was disrupted so much as access to it will be increased by the building of a road.
It's a power. It's where the ordained people of the tribe go to receive their visions, their instructions, to pray for the people in the community. And the effectiveness of their ministry for the tribe and on behalf of the tribe, it would be compromised if that road were built. It would be, and the court agreed with that. The Supreme Court didn't deny that would happen.
O'Connor has a line which she concedes that this action would, quote, virtually destroy the religion of the Native Americans. And that's why I think we deliberately chose the stark term, can it survive? If the court concedes that the effect of this regulation is to destroy the practice of the faith, and it was your faith, and we had some kind of a civic rule that approximated the golden rule, namely you don't want your faith to be bashed the way we're going to bash the Native Americans, well, at that point, you know, all hell should be breaking loose. But
there's a question back here. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, I was just wondering who owns the property that the road could possibly go on if it went around the area to another.
It's all federal property.
It's like where we are now.
It's national forest.
Yeah, it's we're surrounded by a National Forest Service wilderness.
It's surrounded by federal land then.
Right.
They couldn't possibly see in their ways that go around this area.
There, of all the alternatives that were explored by the Forest Service were explored, you saw Dorothy Theodoratis. This is her report about all the alternatives proposed. Every one of the alternatives would have an adverse effect on the religious practice of the Karuk, Yurok, and Talamo people. There isn't an alternative that would not have an adverse effect on the religious practice. And then the own Forest Service experts said that. That's not the question. The issue was that the plaintiff said, well, we have the Freedom Act that says, you know, the government's policy is to help ensure our rights as Indian people. Well, the Supreme Court said that the American Indian Religious Freedom Act does not have any teeth in it. It doesn't say that the courts can enforce the act. It's just a piece of paper that states a policy. Yes, we have to go to legislative branch in order to get some action. But Indian people get really gun shy when they hear going to Congress again, and that the government will never change its mind, because Indian policy has vacillated greatly over the past 100 years, 150, 200
and that's
years.
To put a positive spin on it, say that it's vacillated, because it's been, the vacillation has been on the margin and has been 90% negative.
Well, right.
Way that the treaties have been construed, whether fishing treaties or the like, has not been good for Native Americans. You can find one or two, the Passamaquoddies in Maine, that have won some enforcement of their treaty rights, but it's been a devastating, if they call it the Treaty of Broken Promises. The white man, you know, promises these things in treaties, but, you know, bury my heart at Wounded Knee, that there's no serious, consistent interpretation of these words as though they were effective promises.
Right.
There's a question back there.
Yeah, what's the spotted owl population in that area? That seemed to work around here.
There were other environmental considerations in that case that didn't go from the appeals court up to the Supreme Court, and that in part environmental, if you have to argue, make an argument, you always want to put your best foot forward, make the strongest argument you can.
Well,
environmental argument is not as strong as a First Amendment argument.
You would think.
But when you fail on the First Amendment, then you have to fall back on legislation, on other arguments, including spotted owl or whatever. Like I said, the case is somewhat moot at this point because that road area has been included now in a wilderness area, and the road cannot be built at this point.
When you say at this point, what does that mean? You mean 10
If Congress should decide that it wants to uncreate the Siskiyou Wilderness, or to take a portion of that wilderness and make it into productive forest land again, it can certainly do that. It can vote to do that.
Not without new legislation.
New legislation would be required, right. And it may be very unlikely that will happen. But there are other Indian cases in the country and situations where federal land is being used by Indian practitioners for religious purposes, where the government says, you know, we'd like to do this with this, and the Indian people are saying, well, this interferes with our religious rights, and the government says, well, now look at Ling, it doesn't really matter because we've got the trump card, the courts will back us up. So that's why we need a restoration act, a religious restoration act, that speaks to not only Indian religious freedom, but as Ed has alluded to broader religious freedoms for minority groups in the United States.
Ma'am.
Well, the spotted owl was just it was sort of cover to say the ancient forest. It wasn't so much the spotted owl itself as, I'm a Sierra Club member, and our purpose was to save all these ancient trees that will never be replaced. Mm-hmm. We were actually pushing that, but everybody else around the country was watching, and the environmental people to see what we could do to save not only the ancient forests here, but in other countries too.
Let me ask the folks here, having heard the cases and having learned a bit about what's happening with this court, most of you are members of churches. Is this the kind of thing that you think it would be worth mobilizing some action to articulate your support, your congregation support, your church body support for the Religious Restoration, Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and other measures designed to secure the religious liberties of Native American peoples and other people? Just curious, you're the public.
Well, I think in part some of the churches in our area, speaking for the Pacific Northwest Synod, their focus is on this Snoqualmie Falls situation right now, and I think the whole country is kind of watching that one to see what happens there, because there's a lot of energy focused on the part of the churches at this point in the greater Seattle area on that one anyway. So yes, I think there is some mobilization on the part of some churches. I'm not sure how widespread it is in that.
We had a Sunday where Native Americans were looking at us and so forth, but I didn't get a feeling that this was a real, we were really into this. You know, we really feel good about this. You've done such an excellent presentation here. I mean, it just really makes me feel that if people could hear more of what you said, there would be more sympathy and there would be, you know, more enthusiasm about even Native American Sunday. Otherwise, there wasn't enough information given. It was like, you know, we're going to have this Sunday. There wasn't really much.
Well, I think it's a lot like you said earlier, too. We don't see us as connected with that. It's they. But, you know, you said we should be up in arms, or we could be up in arms, you know, seeing the threat that poses for all of us, not just an indigenous group of people.
When Justice Scalia was asked at a recent symposium that I attended down at Baylor University, the analogous situation of Christian communion, you know, his reply to the question was, "You don't think I thought of that?" Next question. He's confident that the political branches will take care of Catholics. He knows his communion. He knows his community. No prosecutor is going to bust a priest for handing out communion in church. So he's confident that the political process will take care of that. He just doesn't want, as a judge, to construe those words in the Constitution to diminish the political authority, because he thinks it works well for his community. And of course it does. And that is the nub of the problem, is that the most vulnerable minorities for whom the political process doesn't work, the classic instance of which would be the Mormon cases, and now in our century, the Native American cases, or the Jehovah's Witness cases. They're folks who win some, lose some, and the Jehovah, if there's any single group that has sort of helped all of us before this disastrous Smith decision, it was the Jehovah's Witnesses. But there was a concentrated effort to get rid of them from the jurisdiction. Use tax law, use licensing law, use anything you got to get rid of these people. They're pests. And that was the way they were viewed, and that was the purpose of the law. And the Constitution finally was construed to protect them. Now those cases have all been undermined by Justice O'Connor and Justice Scalia and this current court. So we don't have the same sense of empathy and compassion for vulnerable religious minorities who can't raise a big clout in Congress, who depend on the Constitution as a safeguard.
Anne?
I was thinking about what was said about what's happening in the Northwest and thinking about the issues in the Midwest about hunting and fishing rights, and thinking maybe one of the roles of the church can be to draw together some of these regional issues and try to make sense out of them. And I think part of the problem is it is very complicated. Like a case like this is very complicated and hard to make a case for. And yet if there would be some way the church could, I think we all know the cases in our own area.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the church is very divided. I mean, there's Wisconsin, there's a lot of division over whether there should be fishing rights, which isn't religious, but it's, I guess it is, maybe,
I don't know.
But that might be one approach to sort of, if the church could pull together a lot of these cases and be able to find a way to do a good education about what that means to the oppressed minority, and then also what that means. Because I think what's really hard in being involved in church education and advocacy is that it's like you have to get things to reach the large majority, you have to get things in very understandable, small, and because you may get a good portion of a congregation to an adult forum, but even that has to be very basic. And you aren't going to get everybody to the adult forum even too. So I think the role of the church or someone like Holden or some group that would put it together would be to try to maybe connect regional issues and then also to find ways to make it understandable.
Thank you.
What is a constitutional position on the church becoming involved in legislation?
Well, the religious body doesn't sort of suffer any loss of its free speech or associational right to advocate change in society simply because it's religious. If we had that as a rule, then the secularists really would win. And in reply to Ann's comment, I appreciate that very much. We tend to know what the regional issues are. And I don't know whether you heard Eric's reply that fishing is a religious, a sacred issue for the Native Americans. Indeed, the contrast is right there, that they view virtually all aspects of life as related to God. And that, I think, has come out richly in many of the blessings that Eric has read, both as people come and go and from the village and so forth. But short answer to your questions is churches like the Sierra Club, like the NAACP, like other voluntary organizations of a variety of sorts, may advocate change in our civil order without violating the First Amendment.
I think that we're reaching the end of the forum, but I think that what people at Holden need to recognize, and we don't perhaps stress it enough, is that at forums, at presentations, at other things going on in the village, if there's the kind of interest in a particular issue that you it inspires you to want to take it to a larger public yourself, back to your home parishes or your home communities, we have a resource center here at the village right across the hall, and one of the things that the resource center does is to prepare materials for people who want to take them along for the purposes of presenting issues to their local parishes or other community groups. The tape of this forum, which I think, a little unlike a lot of forums in that a lot of information of a very complicated character, you pointed out these matters are complicated, had to be presented clearly. But that tape that we've just made is available, if that would prove of use for an adult forum, Bible class, and so forth. And some of these bills coming through the Congress to address this issue, congresspersons do respond to letters. So if letter writing campaigns seemed appropriate and you want to inspire people to get involved with that, that would certainly be in order. So what I'm saying is, if it happens, as it has, I think, to some of you, because I can tell from your comment you were saying that some of the parishes that you're familiar with are already actively engaged in certain issues, be sure to make use of the resources that the village provides and take them back to your parishes and present some of this, because I think people are oftentimes in these matters simply ignorant of what's going on. And I guess I would want to underscore the point that Ed made. It's a special opportunity, it seems to me, to take seriously that aspect of the Christian gospel that suggests we ought especially to look after the interest and needs of those who are, relative to us, rather powerless in the situation. I mean, Scalia's cavalier remark about how the political process will take care of the Catholics, but he can rule the way he does because he knows that same process, he thinks, won't take care of the Native Americans, is kind of scandalous. And it seems to me that unless some of us become involved, these people will continue to suffer. So, in other words, there are things that you can do, it seems to me. Would you like to add that?
Well, I just wanted to ask if there was a known understanding of what the candidates for president, what their standing was on this, this issue.
George Bush told us that when he was in a foxhole or wherever he was in World War II, that he survived by thinking of mother and the separation of church and state. If you can believe that story, and if you can believe that either Ross Perot or the governor of Arkansas has a well-articulated, thoughtful view of these matters, then I suppose we could, again, just trust the political process. I don't think the presidential candidates have ever been asked a very hard, thoughtful question about religion and American culture. And yet we, I guess, have to think of Abraham Lincoln, probably our greatest theologian. Charity towards all and malice towards none, that's not a bad way to think about American life. I don't know. I don't think I know of a single hard question that's been put to a candidate for the presidency other than this kind of anti-religious bias that comes out every once in a while, that if you engage in political discourse, then you're weird religiously. That surfaced in the 1984 campaign.
Maybe we can get Larry King to ask him.
Okay, we can.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good evening.